Let's talk a bunch of different topics.
How'd her career get there?
This is a podcast with Lauren Asghari.
This is the Lauren Asghari podcast, How'd Her Career Get There? And my guest today is Jill Demby Guest, a Emmy-nominated, award-winning producer, director, and writer. So welcome, Jill.
Great to be here. Nice to meet you, Lauren.
You as well. So let's start and kind of get right into it. We're going to get to a little bit later in the conversation talking about your new film, And Now Love. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about you. So I know that you're currently on West Coast in Los Angeles. Let's get in our time machine and go back a little bit.
Sure.
And talk about, like, you as a kid, where were you born? How did you grow up? What were you like as a child? Siblings? Let's kind of start there.
Sure. I was an East Coaster. I was born in Newark, New Jersey. And I have, you know, one sibling. And me as a child growing up, you know, it's interesting because I had two working parents at a time when people didn't have that. I mean, my mother was a real go-getter. I mean, she was in the fashion business in New York City. My mother and father had their own, you know, kind of very high-end retail shop in Newark, New Jersey when it was in its heyday. So I spent a lot of my life around, you know, kind of these fitting rooms and sewing machines and people, you know, really beautiful garments. And I learned very early on, you know, what was a good garment, you know, what were the seams like? Did the plaids match? You know, all the details of what it takes to make a great garment. And my mother was pretty much a fashion queen. I mean, you know, I remember, you know, I would watch her every morning before she went to work. You know, I'd be in the bathroom and I'd watch her carefully putting on her makeup and eyeliner back then. And just, I was mesmerized by her. And, you know, when she would leave for work in the morning, I would go into her lingerie drawers and I would actually try on her girdles and bras and... You know, as a little kid, and I did that over the years. So there was this progression of, like, you know, a four-year-old going into, you know, until I could fit into her clothes, right? So that was, you know, a big part of my life. And, you know, my mother was quite artistic and, you know, loved fashion design and also did some sketching and drawing. And then my father as well. I mean, my father was... from the South. He was from Birmingham, Alabama, and I'm from a Jewish family. And so he was an oddity, you know, a Southern Jew, very eccentric, very entrepreneurial. And so they were a pretty great combination, you know, certainly early on. And, you know, I would come home to find, one day I came home and I found, you know, these striped tents in the backyard. They were cabanas. And my father would say, oh, look what I found these cabanas. They're going to be great. I can sell them. And he did, you know, he was a really great sales guy, you know, and that was why, you know, at the same time he held a job, I think he was managing the women's coat department at Saks Fifth Avenue or something. So it was pretty, you know, he was a character.
What would you say from your parents, either as individuals or collectively, would you say, like, the major one or two life lessons or things that you learned from them that you've really carried through to who you are now?
Well, I think certainly from my dad, because he was such a go-getter. It's like, you know, just, you know, go to the beat of your own drum and, you know, kind of, you know, people are great, but no one really knows anything that, you know, I mean, you can... you know, get advice for sure. But, you know, you're going to have to follow what makes you tick at some point. And I think he always said to me early on, you know, it's such a cliche, but he would say to me as a young girl, you know, the world is really your oyster. And I didn't even know what the hell that meant then, you know, and it was just like, all right, whatever, you know? And so, and he always encouraged me, you know, up until I decided to get into the film business. And then they both thought I was nuts. But later on, you know, they certainly came around. But yeah, so that was one thing, certainly from my dad. And from my mom, it was really so many things. I mean, she always looked great. I mean, I never looked as great as she did, you know, so it wasn't like I was leaving the house with perfect, you know, matching bag and shoes, you know, like she did. but she had a sense of humor about her too, you know, so even that, you know, I mean, we had a certain sense of humor together as well, but it was my dad who was kind of the wild one.
And what were you like, not so much what were you like, but obviously, you know, getting into your mom's clothes, but what do you remember, or do you remember thinking, or I want to be X when I, you know, I'm air quoting grow up, right? But, you know, as a kid, what were your interests and what were your kind of ambitions even at that age?
It's interesting because, like I said, I had two working parents. So there were nannies around, some better than others, believe me. And but I got very close to a neighbor of mine who lived, you know, in the backyard, kind of our backyard kind of thing. And she was a nurse who had no children. And she taught me how to take care of dogs. And I became such a dog kind of acolyte. I mean, I just went crazy for dogs. And so I thought I wanted to be a vet when I was like 5 or 6 or something like that. And then she also trained me to play the piano. And she taught me by ear, and I was quite good at it. And she got me an audition with a piano teacher from New York who got people into Juilliard. I was probably 10 or 11. I didn't know. I couldn't read music even. So I auditioned for this, teacher. And I'll never forget the audition. It was incredible. And the teacher was speechless. And she trained me for a few years. And then I dropped it. I got into boys. But for a little while, I thought I wanted to be, you know, a concert pianist.
Speechless because you had done such a great job.
I had done so well, and I couldn't read a note of music. I mean, I had learned to play by ear, and I could transcribe music. I mean, I could, you know, I just learned how to, I just knew how to do it. I guess I had a gift for it. So, you know, and that went okay for a few years, and then I screwed it up. But,
you just lost interest
in it? I got into puberty, and I started, you know, getting the boys, and lost interest in it. So, yeah. So, you know, early on, it was a dog trainer, then a concert pianist, and then I always wrote stories. So I was constantly writing stories about boys I had crushes on, and I had like a huge book like this of these short stories I would write. And then I thought I wanted to be a writer in high school, and I told my parents that I didn't want to go to college. I just wanted to go to Cape Cod. And I didn't know how I was going to get the money to do this, by the way. I just wanted to go to Cape Cod, get a cabin and write. And then they thought I was completely insane. Like what, you know? And yeah. I had a brother who was 7 years older than me, who really was in charge of me for so long. And I think because he had such a good life with my parents before I came along, you know, it was kind of torture, you know, and so kind of navigating that. And, you know, it was almost like being an only child, but he was around for a little while. And, you know, he was my first love. I mean, I just admired him so greatly. And so that was really kind of wonderful.
Was he on the, so when you talk about, you know, telling your parents that you want to be a writer, and it's always interesting when you have an older sibling that may or may not chart the course one way or the other.
Right.
And whether it was that your brother, you know, did go to college or your parents valued that, my question is, how much of an emphasis did they put on education and college? And did you end up going, or when you gave them that news that you weren't interested, how did that kind of unravel or transpire?
Well, they were, neither of my parents were college educated. So they put a big emphasis on college, you know. And my brother being older than me, you know, he had to be a lawyer, a doctor, you know, that was pretty much it. So, but they didn't put that on me, which was interesting because there again, you know, it was the female thing back then. And, you know, even though my mother was a working mother, it was weird. It was like, my father said, no, you should be a teacher. So you'll have something to, you know, it was that classic thing. You should be a teacher because you have something to fall back on. And I think he knew it was bullshit coming out of his mouth because there was no way that I reflected anything about teaching skills. You know, I mean, I was sitting in my room writing. I mean, who was I teaching? I mean, true, you know, I mean, I had some jobs, you know, after school where at the community center where I would teach gymnastics or something, but I didn't really, I couldn't see where I was showing signs of that being my path. So it really made me kind of laugh. And my brother, I mean, he was so well-educated and so smart and such a reader, but I don't think he knew how that was going to shake out as a career.
Mm-hmm. So you go in and you tell your parents, I don't want to go to college. I want to go write, and I want to go to Cape Cod and do this, and take us kind of through from there to how things kind of transpired to get your career started.
Well, they just ignored me about that. You know, they said, you know, you're definitely going to college, and I had gotten a scholarship. So I was going, you know, and I, you know, balked at it, but I went, and I'm, you know, glad that I did.
And where did you go? What college?
I ended up going to Ohio University. I could have gone to Beaver College for Women, but I ended up at the State University in Ohio. So, yeah, and it was a great place. It was incredibly, I mean, I didn't know anything about it, but it was incredibly progressive. And I ended up being in the Honors College there. And their Honors College was, it was built on the English tutorial system. So I had a tutor basically for my 4 years where I would just, I created my own program. It was really progressive and pretty fantastic, I have to say.
And so then you go there, you graduate, and then what do you do when you're coming out of school?
Well, there's more to that story, actually.
Okay.
As I started, I was studying Russian. I was quite good at languages. So I didn't know what I was going to do. So I was studying Russian and psychology. You know, it was a little Russian and a little psychology. And I thought, oh, maybe I'd get into what I was going to do with a Russian degree. But anyway, I took a Film 101 course, and I saw this movie called Last Year at Marienbad, which was a French film by the director, Alain René. He was part of the French New Wave at the time. And it would knock my socks off. I didn't know what the story was about. There was no story, but it was just flashbacks and, you know, weirdness and, you know, playing with time and emotion. But it really got to me. And I thought, what is this? I said, I mean, there's something that can actually do that and evoke all that emotion in me. And I don't know what the hell it is. You know, this confluence of pictures, words, and music. And I was like, wow. So I went and I spoke to the head of the film department, and I said, hey, I want to change my major. And I did. My parents were not happy about this. But I did. And I was the only woman in my graduating film class. There was probably, I don't know, at that time, 15 of us. And we had there was a little film house, you know, in the backyard of, I don't know, it was like in a bungalow. It wasn't even real part of the university. So there's this little bungalow we had, and it was called the Film House. We called it the Film Haus, H-A-U-S.
Fancy.
And it was run by this fantastic guy who ran the program, Joseph Anderson, who was the co-author of the Bible of the Japanese film. It was called, this book is still today, The Japanese Film. It's the Bible of Japanese film. And he co-authored that. And he was one of the coolest people I've ever met. And there was a sign scrawled on the wall of the film house that said, cleanliness is next to godliness, but what is godliness next to? ... Okay. So you get an idea of like where, what I was dealing with. And, but interestingly enough, they had in this little town in Ohio, we had the most up-to-date equipment. We had flatbed editing machines at a time when I don't even think NYU had them at the time, but we had these flatbed editing machines called the Acme. They were from England. It was fantastic. We had all the up-to-date cameras. So we were making, you know, little movies, you know, 16-millimeter movies.
And was that it for you? And when I say that it for you, like, boom, this is what I want to do, something in this? Like,
That
was it.
Yeah. That was definitely the bell went off, yeah.
Yeah. And was it that, this is always interesting to me, and maybe you remember, maybe you don't, but was it that moment that you like went into the class or that you started talking with someone else about it? Like, was there a moment that clicked for you with like, this is my passion?
Well, it was the moment I saw that film Last Year at Marienbad, and then all these other French New Wave films. I seriously got into Jean-Luc Godard, who just passed, who was kind of my idol at the time. And I watched all of his film multiple times. I saw his film Weekend probably 10 times. And I did my final thesis on that film, which was really quite a prophetic film. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't even get my brother to watch that film once. I mean, they all thought I was crazy. But they, it was very kind of French New Wave, Eastern European kind of dark films about mental states. And, you know, I just thought, wow, this is fantastic. What is this? I mean, you can get inside people's minds. And wow, I just was, you know, blown away.
Blown away. And so then you graduate. And then where do you go from there?
Well, I had applied to graduate school and I got into the London film because I had spent the summer in London the year before working, actually, and I fell in love with it. So I visited London Film School and I met the guy that ran the British Film Institute, and I applied to London Film School and I got in, and I really wanted to go there. I also had gotten into USC, but I wanted to be back in Europe. So I left film school and my parents didn't want me to go to graduate school. And so I had to make money to go to graduate school. So London Film School said, yeah, you can come in the winter or spring, whatever you want. So I ended up going to New York City to get a job because my mom commuted into New York every day. So I would take the train with her. And I ended up getting a job at Madison Square Garden Productions for the director of productions. Now, they hired me as a secretary. I mean, I got to tell you, I could barely type. But I was dealing with the two guys that ran all the shows in the garden, and they were rock concerts and the dog shows and the cat shows and everything that went on in every part of Madison Square Garden. So it was a pretty great place to be, you know. I didn't realize it at the time because I was so depressed. I had just come out of film school. Wasn't I a filmmaker? You know, all the things that film students think. I was an asshole, you know. I knew everything. What do you mean? I added one thing. I know what to do. So I was, you know, trying to make money to go to film school, graduate school. And I met the tour director and lighting designer for the Rolling Stones, because all the rock concert guys would be up there. Most of them wanted to sell me drugs. But this guy just loved young people. And we would have real soulful conversations. And what are you doing? And I said, well, you know, I need a place to edit my thesis film in New York. And he said, well, I'm good friends with the Maisel brothers who had just done, documentarians who had just done Gimme Shelter, that film on the Rolling Stones, mm-hmm. at the Altamont, where there was a murder. And they were my idols because I had seen Salesman, I'd seen everything. So he said, you know, why don't you call them and see? And so I called them, went up there, and they said, yeah, use our editing rooms at night. And then I met the whole community of people that worked there, many of which were women. And I was like, wow, this is a shocker. So I became friends. And some of these women that I met are still my best friends today. I mean, I got all involved with them, and they ended up hiring me and gave me my first job and trained me as a film editor. And then I did some assistant camera work for Al Maisel's, and I also shot some second camera stuff, but I decided I didn't want to be a camera person. So they trained me to be an editor, and I was one lucky person, you know, talk about right timing at the right place and the right people and, you know, just fortuitous events coming together. So I quit my job at Madison Square Garden and never looked back. I didn't go to graduate school. And I was making money.
So this is interesting. Sorry to interrupt you, but I want to back up and stay on this for 1 minute, because you call it luck, and I'm not saying it is or isn't, but talk a little bit about, so a couple of things that you said in that, you know, past few minutes there. First job, putting yourself, you know, a secretary role where you couldn't type, but putting yourself in the room with something closer to maybe what you were interested in. And then the second part, calling and asking for, and I apologize, I forgot what you said, but asking for, if you could use their studio, right? Versus not right. making the call. So talk right. a little bit about just your perspective, whether it relates to you personally or in general, about putting yourself in the room or putting yourself in situations to create opportunities for yourself versus not.
Well, I mean, if you don't ask, you know, they say closed mouths don't get fed, but if you don't ask, there's pretty much not, you know, probably not going to happen, or it may happen in some other way. I never say never. So I don't know, you know, just for me, that how it works. I had to make the call, and I got the woman who answered the phone was the secretary for them. And she was incredibly chatty and wonderful. And she and I, she's still my best friend. And, you know, just getting to meet her alone, who cared about the work? I mean, we had such a good time together. And then, you know, then I met other women up there and we just hung out all the time. So, and then one thing led to another. They say, oh, you know, Jill's good at this. Why don't you hire her to sync up dailies? And so I kept working on one show after the next.
And then what happens in between? And this is a long period to capture, so I'll leave it to you to
yes, it is.
To summarize. Yeah, I mean, how do you go from that to, writing? And the End Now Love, I just want to make sure I have it right, wrote, directed, and produced?
I did, yes.
Yeah, all three. And that is streaming on Amazon. I'm going to let
Amazon.
You do it.
It's streaming on Amazon and Apple TV Plus, Vudu, and other platforms. It's on a bunch of platforms right now.
Okay, so a couple of things here along the way to talk about, I'll come back to the movie
sure.
today and where it's streaming. But how do you get from that to you wrote, directed, and produced your own movie? I mean, what along the way happens?
Well, in the documentary field, that is often how it goes. It's guerrilla filmmaking. So you just got to jump it into everything. So that's pretty much how that happened. And then I learned more things along the way as I started producing, you know, higher end things, because I didn't always work in documentaries. So, you know, you just learn as you go along. And then I got the opportunity to, after the Maisel Brothers experience, I was hired by a woman film editor to come be her assistant on an 8-part series for public television in New York, which is the station when they were producing was WNET in New York. And it was about American filmmakers. It was Raoul Walsh, William Wellman, George Cukor, King Vidor, Vincent Minnelli, Howard Hawks, Alfred Hitchcock, you know. So I said yes, and I worked on the pilot with her, and she, after that, decided she wasn't going to be a film editor anymore. So I inherited her position, and I worked with the film critic at the time, Richard Schickel, who was writing and producing the series. So I became his editor for probably 10 years, you know, on overlapping projects that we produced for public television. And then I became his producer. So I was editing, and then I became an associate producer, and then I became his producer. So that all happened because he was a busy guy.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have a lot of time to be doing all this stuff. So I was picking up, you know, the work and doing it. So I just, once again, I just jumped in and did what needed to be done. And I learned along the way.
And then how do you, what happens after that? So you're there for 10 years, and then you go where?
Then I end up, I was getting opportunities to get for jobs in Los Angeles, because I was in the editors union in New York, and it was a very small feature film community in New York, and was hard to break into. And I wanted to break into features. So I'll back up a little. I started breaking into features as a music and sound editor. So I was doing that. But when there was a bunch of films coming to New York, and I was hired as what they call a standby editor, because the union demanded that the New York union, if California people were coming in with a California editor, you had to have a standby editor who was in the New York union. And I would act as an assistant editor, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So a film came to New York called The Bell Jar. It was a Sylvia Plath novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hired by this editor to be his standby assistant. I don't even know how that came about, to be honest. But it did. And so I said yes. And we shot the film in New York. And then they took me to LA to finish the film. So I was in LA for 6 months, and they got me in the union in Los Angeles. And they did not want women in the union at that time out there. You know, they didn't want New York people coming out there. So but some, you know, because I was out there working on a union film, I got in the union. So I was both New York and LA editors union. So that happened. And then another opportunity came along the next time, which was to be a standby editor for Walter Hill's film, The Long Riders. And I went on location with them in, you know, Georgia and North Carolina, I think we were in. And then they took me to LA to finish the film as well. So I was kind of what they call bi-coastal for many years, actually.
What guidance or advice would you give people either early in their career or just people that are interested? This is kind of a two-part question. Those that are interested in getting into, what advice would you give young filmmakers? Let me ask it that way.
I would say if you want to be, you know, a director or a producer or a writer, you know, I would say make something, because when I was growing up, the barrier to entry was pretty stiff because, you know, 16 millimeter cameras or 35 millimeter cameras were, you know, prohibitively expensive unless you had a trust fund or, you know, were very, very, you know, what should I say, tenacious in, mm-hmm. in going to film houses and borrowing, you know, rental equipment. But, you know, and processing film was quite expensive and buying it. So now there is no excuse not to do something, you know, a short film, even if it's a minute long. I mean, there is a 1 minute film that was, you know, in the Academy Award submissions, official Academy Award submission for the Oscars a couple of years ago, which was excellent mm-hmm. and very creative, but there's no reason not to do it. If you want to be a writer director. Now, if you want to go into development at a streamer or a studio or whatever, that's a different story. Then I would say probably suck it up and work for an agency if you can afford to do it, because you'll meet everybody.
So let's talk about the film And Now Love. Let's talk about give an overview of what the story is and then what inspired you to make it.
Well, the overview of the story is that it's about Dr. Bernard Bale, who became a psychoanalyst, but he was a World War II veteran, Jewish veteran, who had been shot down by the Nazis and captured and went to a German hospital. And when he was in a German hospital, he fell in love with his German nurse, which was through a series of clandestine love letters that they had. And this experience, she not only saved his life, but she changed his mind about so many things. He learned what he felt was the power of the divine feminine. He had never had a relationship with a woman like that in his life. And he wanted to become a healer because after experiencing the horrors of war, he just wanted to be a healer. He said, how can I help create a world where there will be no war? How can I help put an end to war, basically? And he ended up going back to Philadelphia, where he was from, and becoming a doctor and then psychoanalyst, who really pioneered a theory about transgenerational transmission of trauma in utero. I mean, was a huge advocate of women and saw women's oppression early on and truly felt that, you know, we'll never have peace in the world if women are not instrumental in having a seat at the table. So he was an incredible human being. And to go on about why I wanted to do this is, when I met him, I mean, he was this, you know, probably 5'5". I mean, he was 95 years old. And he was so cogent and smart and so devoted to healing. It was just, it was overwhelming in a way to meet someone who his whole body, you know, is devoted to healing mental anguish. And so his resilience, his courage, his bravery, his, you know, devotion to freeing the love in us all, basically, it just overwhelmed me. And plus he was funny and a raconteur. And I thought, you know, I spent probably 20 hours talking to him just on audio before I agreed to do it, because I wanted to make sure that he was going to be a good subject, a worthy subject. And was he going to be vulnerable? I mean, here he was a psychoanalyst who, you know, nobody knows about his life. You know, and you're not supposed to. So would he be willing to do that on film? He was at an age where, what the hell? I mean, I'm 95. How many more years am I going to be working, right? So once I knew that he was going to be vulnerable. And, you know, he was funny and poignant and everything and so articulate. And the way he spoke was so beautiful that I wanted to do it. Because here's a guy, I mean, he fought oppression on every front. You know, he fought it in Europe against the Nazis. Then he came home and he had to fight at anti-Semitism in his own country, you know, after he fought the war. And then at the institute, you know, the institute that trained him, you know, oppression of free thinking, you know, crazy, right? And he was ousted from that, you know, and so he was a free thinker. And he had a lot to say about that. And also, you know, his real, you know, feeling that love will conquer all. So, oh, I think you got muted.
I did.
Yeah, you got muted.
How proud are you of this film?
I'm actually very proud of it. I think that, you know, no film is perfect. I will say that, but I think I did the most perfect job that I could do at the time. You know, of course, you look at things later and think, oh, why didn't I do this? Why didn't I do that? But basically, I'm really proud of it. My thing is I like to make stories that make you feel. I always have done that. And I feel this film accomplishes that. And, you know, when I look at certain scenes and, you know, when you're in the editing room for so many months and you think, you know, oh, how's this going to, you know, you know, the chaos of creation, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. You know, you're in there and like, okay, you know, you get a scene that comes together, the pictures, the words, the music all work. And you get that feeling in your gut of like, I feel it, you know, now this is really, it's going to be something. And so that's, you know, I'm proud of it. Yeah, I am. Yeah.
And say one more time for the audience, where can they watch it? What services, streaming services is it on?
Well, anyone can watch And Now Love on Apple TV Plus, Amazon Prime, or Vudu, or it's on a bunch of other platforms too, if you just Google it. It's there for the taking. Wonderful. If you watch it on Amazon and you love it, leave a review.
There you go. So I want to get to some rapid fire questions, random, totally unrelated to what we've talked about so far. But before I do that, I have one last question for you. Mm-hmm. How do you define success?
I love that question, actually. I have a couple of ways, so I'm going to just say, and they feed into each other. Well, one is that the ability to find the joy in life no matter what, which is to me the, you know, because it's not all roses, right? So the ability to see in the dark, you know, to be able to, even in your worst moments, to be able to look up and see a rose or a butterfly or something and get some joy. And the wisdom really to know that this too shall pass. So I speak from experience. So to know this too shall pass.
I love that. The ability to see in the dark. I might steal that from you. I love that expression.
Yeah. Tag me on it.
So I'm going to do some rapid fire questions. Is there anything else before I get to those actually that you want to cover or talk about that we haven't yet talked about?
No, not really. I mean, you know, there was a long path before And Now Love, but it's, you know, is what it is.
Do you want to get into any of that?
No, I mean, I will say that I think what helped me a lot actually was I did a bunch of I did a lot of commercials and I worked in also entertainment marketing. I was creative director on trailers and stuff. And I think that really helped me story-wise. Because even now when I have an idea, I usually will write a trailer about it first. Sort of as a proof of concept, which is weird. I mean, it's sort of like, and you know, and also, you know, copy lines, tag lines, that's, you know, comes to me pretty easily because I was a copywriter as well. But all those things that you think like, oh, what am I, you know, what is this? How is this going to, it all kind of feeds into each other. You know, you're still using your brain in a creative way. You're solving creative solutions in how to tell a story, whether it's 15 seconds, 30 seconds, a minute, or 3 minutes in a trailer, you know, it's how you can, you know, I love to be, and also being in the editing room was really, monumental. I mean, learning how to do that, because you know how to cut things down to their core, you know, see what you're going to say.
So did you realize at the time, as you were doing all of those things throughout your career, did you realize how much you would use all those skills along the way?
I actually didn't, because I thought, oh, I'm just doing commercial, you know, advertising just to make some money. I wasn't really thinking about how that could feed into a longer story, or how actually important that was to be able to cull down, you know, the important points. Really important, actually. I'm shocked today even how important I find it. Because even in, you know, storyboarding something, it's almost trailer-like, you know.
So would you give, I mean, do you think that's a good place? I guess maybe it depends on the person's creative process, but do you think that's a good place to start? I mean, those skills in general are good places to start for people that want to maybe aspire to feature films or aspire to...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Because look at Ridley Scott, you know, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it's an incredible way to make money and hone your craft and your visuals and everything. I mean, you know, I wish I had gotten on that track earlier on, but yeah, for sure. It's an excellent way.
And to that, I keep saying my last question, this really is my last question before rapid fire. What advice would you give your younger self?
That's a really good question. My younger self, I would just say confidence.
It's a big one.
It's a huge one.
I think that is one thing that is wildly underestimated in how much it matters and how much people put themselves out for opportunities or don't. And how... When you have more confidence and put yourself in better situations, I think that a lot of people end up surprising themselves, you know, just once they're able to give something a try.
It's absolutely true. And like, you know, what you said, we were starting to talk about luck the other day. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, oh, well, it's a lucky break or whatever, or, you know, this film coming together the way it did, it was really luck. But, you know, Oprah says... about luck, which I think is a beautiful thing. She said, you know, it's timing. I'm paraphrasing, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, it's timing and opportunity coming together. But if you hadn't been capable of it, you know, it wouldn't be luck, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yep. I love that. I know which one you're, I know exactly what you're, you know what I mean? Phrase. Yeah. The preparation and opportunity.
Preparation and opportunity. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, I hadn't had that background before it wouldn't have, you know.
Led you to where you are.
Exactly.
So let's go into rapid fire. Again, totally unrelated to what we've talked about so far. So just kind of first thing that comes to mind, I don't know, maybe six or seven questions here. Drama or comedy?
Comedy.
Sand or ocean?
Ocean.
Grass or sky?
Sky.
East Coast, West Coast.
East Coast.
Astronaut or deep sea diver?
Astronaut.
Brick or stone?
Brick.
And the last one, Android or Apple?
Apple.
All right. That is all we have on this episode of the Lauren Asghari podcast, How'd Her Career Get There? My guest again, Jill Demby, guest. And her new film is out, And Now Love. We'll link it up in the comments where you can find it, all the streaming services that you can get it on, or just Google it and find out all the wonderful places that you can see it and also learn more about Jill. So Jill, thank you so much for joining. It was really wonderful talking with you.
My pleasure. I had a great time.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Take care. All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's talk a bunch of different topics.
How'd her career get there?
This is a podcast with Lauren Asghari.